You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest is novelist, biographer, and historian of American popular culture, James Kaplan. He's the author of several books, including the definitive two-volume biography of Frank Sinatra. James Kaplan's latest book is an entry in the Jewish Lives series from Yale University Press. It's a biography of one of the most gifted and prolific songwriters of the 20th century. Irving Berlin's songbook includes White Christmas, God Bless America, Cheek to Cheek, Blue Skies, Always, I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm, Heat Wave, How Deep is the Ocean, and about 20,000 more. The book is called Irving Berlin, New York a Genius. James Kaplan, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, I always love coming to visit you. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, thank you. The book is sorely needed. I mean, I think people will be shocked by how many Irving Berlin songs they know and love.
Yes, and how many Irving Berlin songs they never heard of but would love to get to know.
You found a lot of those.
Well, there are 1,500 to choose from, and Berlin always used to say, I wrote more bad songs than anyone, but another way of putting that would be he wrote more songs than anyone.
Well, that's why it's kind of interesting. I mean, I love Irving Berlin's music, and I knew it well. But I also know the life of Cole Porter and George Gershwin. I mean, those lives have been kind of legendary. Why hadn't there ever been a major Irving Berlin book?
Well, there was, in fact, one about 20 years ago by Lawrence Berggreen called As Thousands Cheer. And it's a big, comprehensive, cradle-to-grave biography. And I will gently say that it's got some mistakes in it. The Berlin family was very unhappy with the book, and not just because I think that Berggreen might have come in the time-honored way of many biographers to feel some dislike for his subject, but because there are mistakes in the book. It's not that I set out to redress all the mistakes, but my book is a very different animal. It is not a big compendium, but I thought humbly that I could maybe do a little better.
There's lots of biographies of people that have had biographies written of them before, including Frank Sinatra. You certainly wasn't the first or last Frank Sinatra biography. Why do you think authors tackle a biography that's already been written?
Well, in my case, only because I would only ever do it if I thought there was a chance to do something different and maybe something better. In the case of Sinatra, all the books that had been written about Sinatra, all the biographies, had been books about the women and the mob and the fist fights. And in the case of Berlin, there were musical books, there were academic books, very academic books, and then there was this one biography. But I thought that he hadn't been done justice. I had my own history of discovering Berlin. I became enraptured by him as a young man when I happened upon, strictly by accident, a recording of Berlin at age 21 in 1909, singing a song he had written. This is on a very early phonograph record, singing a song he had written called Oh, How That German Could Love. And when I heard this song, which was, I think I say something in the book about how it sort of pierced the veil of time, when it reached me in this very direct and visceral way. I was a very young man when I heard it, but I heard this young man singing, and I felt his energy and his genius, and I wanted to know more, and that's really what set me off on my quest.
Were you surprised to discover how bawdy some of his songs were? I mean, she started a heat wave by making her seat wave.
Yeah, that's nothing, because Berlin, it's an amazing story of his life, but one of the facts that continues to astound me every day, and particularly as the father of sons, is that when Berlin's own father died. His name, Berlin's name was then Israel Balin. Berlin was living with his family on the Lower East Side in a crowded apartment. His father died. There was no money coming in, and Izzy, young Izzy, was 14 when his father died, and felt that he was a financial drag on the family. He left home and went out to live on the streets of the Bowery by himself at age 14, wound up being a singing waiter at a bar that was full of drunken patrons, and drunken patrons, all male, doing what drunken patrons do and yelling and not being especially polite. And here's 14-year-old Izzy Balin, a singing waiter in a bar on the Lower East Side, and quickly finds that one of his skills is making up dirty lyrics to popular songs.
I'm sure that was a valuable skill. I mean, was it unusual for a 14-year-old to live on their own in New York then?
I suspect not. I'm afraid, highly unusual was for one to survive and thrive and prosper. I'm still astonished that he made it. There's so many chances. He used to live in these pay 25 cents a night hotels, rooming houses for sailors, and God only knows what he might have been subjected to in these hotels. One time he got into a knife fight with a kid. Berlin didn't have the knife. The kid did. Berlin got stabbed. There are all kinds of near misses in his early life, and then he lived to be 101.
Yeah, crazy. And that body quality really is present throughout his work. I mean, I'm thinking of my little baby brother. He never read a book. Knows one sex from the other. All he had to do was look.
He was the thing that I worry about sometimes, and that I have to struggle against, and trying to convince people about Irving Berlin is what they know is Easter Parade and God Bless America and White Christmas, and they think of Berlin as a sort of, if they think of him at all, as a sort of cute old man who wrote cute songs, and in fact, he was tough, he was dark, he was depressed, he had terrible early loss, not just his father, but his first wife, who died after they went on honeymoon to Havana, and she caught typhoid, died 3 months after they returned, and Berlin was a widower at 24. He lost an infant son after his second marriage. A lot of loss, a lot of gloom in his life, and his songs, his best songs, and even the second-tier songs of Irving Berlin, are full of depth and major to minor changes and dimension and richness that other people's songs don't quite have in the same way.
So the sunny vision of Irving Berlin is incorrect. So you're saying that as a person who... Did he suffer from depression, or what it would be clinical depression?
He did. He did. He took his army show, This Is the Army. It was the second show, army show he had written. He wrote one in World War One too. In World War Two, he wrote This Is the Army. He took it with an all-army cast on tour across America and then around the world. He took it to, this is the middle of World War Two, took it to Great Britain while London was being bombed, and then took the show and the cast, all soldier cast, down to Italy within the sound of bombing and guns. They performed, they entertained the troops, and then to the South Pacific, jumping from atoll to atoll and little island to island, up across the Pacific as the Army and the U.S. Army and Navy and Marines fought the Japanese, and there were, again, within the sounds of shooting. By the time World War II was finished, Berlin was really, he was 57 years old. He was exhausted. He had one last great burst of creativity and energy. That's a whole story in itself, how he came to write Annie, Get Your Gun in 1946. But after that was done, he fell into a terrible clinical depression and was in fact hospitalized for much of the 1950s.
And so you think in his songs, in his love songs, there's that, there's a darker tone to them.
Yes, well, he knew loss immediately in his love life. He married at 23, just 24 when his wife died after a couple of months, his first wife, Dorothy, and wrote a great song about losing her. He couldn't help writing it. He just wrote it, called When I Lost You, that's still recorded to this day, beautifully, by Tony Bennett, by Frank Sinatra, and many others. So he knew deep loss, deep sorrow, and the fact that he wrote so many great snappy songs, I Love a Piano, Putting on the Ritz, Let Yourself Go, is a testament to something very big.
I lost the sunshine and roses. I lost the heavens of blue. I lost the beautiful rainbow. I lost the morning dew. I lost the angel who gave me summer the whole winter through. I lost the gladness that turned into sadness when I lost you.
James Kaplan, this book, Irving Berlin, New York Genius, is in a series of biographies of Jewish lives, Ben Hecht, Jerome Robbins, Houdini, Barbara Streisand, Groucho, and lots of others in the arts and politics and history. So to what degree did the fact that Irving Berlin was Jewish impact his work and life?
So I would say that though he was not an observant Jew, that Berlin was deeply Jewish. The thing I always say is we talk about secular Jews in a way we don't talk about any other religion. You don't talk about really secular Christians, secular Muslims. But so many Jews, the present company included, the guy on this end of the conversation.
And this one.
Think of ourselves as secular, and yet at the same time I think of myself as a Jew through and through, and I think Berlin did too. He was very much a New York Jew. He talked that talk. He walked that walk. He had that wit, that kosher salt, and it really infused his work, every syllable, every note that he wrote.
When you think of secular Judaism, I think part of that, at least, in addition to being a cultural thing, is also due to anti-Semitism. That is, non-Jews don't believe you can walk away from Judaism.
That's right. And, of course, we have so many flaws and so many nefarious activities that we pursue in secret. So, and we're always, all of us, in touch with all the rest of us. It is a hard pill for some people to swallow, and Jewish survival is a hard pill for some people to swallow, the miracle of Jewish survival. And Berlin represents, I think, kind of a miracle in himself, not only his 101-year life, which was mixed. We all want to live to an old age, a ripe old age, but old age can be a curse as well as a blessing, and I think for Berlin, it was in many ways, but he thrived. He thrived. He had an amazing career, a very long career. He wrote very many great things, and he outlived a lot of his detractors, and even one very great detractor, the great Harry Warren of Hollywood songwriting fame, who for some reason that nobody understands hated the ground that Berlin walked on, the great writer of 42nd Street and all those amazing Hollywood anthems, Harry Warren, after World War II famously said they bombed the wrong Berlin.
That's more clever than any of the songs that he wrote for them.
Well, Harry Warren had lyricists. Irving Berlin, like the great Cole Porter, was his own lyricist, and the great Frank Lesser as well. It's an extreme rarity for somebody to be able to do both those things so brilliantly. It's unimaginable to ordinary humans. To me, it's like playing blindfold chess or something like that I can't even conceive of.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're chatting today with James Kaplan. He's the author of several books, including the definitive biography of Frank Sinatra. His latest book in the Jewish Lives series from Yale University Press is called Irving Berlin, New York Genius. One of Irving Berlin's most famous songs was God Bless America. It was recorded by many people, including, of course, Kate Smith. But let's listen to Bing Crosby's recording from 1939, which includes the rarely heard verse.
While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair as we raise our voices in a solemn prayer. God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam, God bless America, my home, sweet home.
That was Bing Crosby singing God Bless America. This is From the Bookshelf. We're chatting today with James Kaplan. He's the author of a biography of the composer of that song, Irving Berlin. Recently, the Yankees and other teams, they stopped playing Kate Smith's record of God Bless America because she had also recorded some racially insensitive songs in the 1920s.
And particularly, there was one in particular that that I think we maybe shouldn't even say the title of, but it contained a racial epithet, not the N-word, but another one, that at the time was considered by white people to be very innocuous, is something they would just sort of toss around. God alone knows what black people were thinking about it. But yeah, no, they stopped playing Kate Smith, God Bless America. They took down a statue of her someplace. Berlin, along with all his other songwriting with many, along with many other songwriters in the early 1900s, wrote dozens upon dozens of so-called ethnic songs, and they had all kinds of names for them, and the names for them, names for these ethnic songs, contained racial epithets. So the most benign of which would be, you'd hear, they would write, well, they're not that benign, really, but there were African-American songs that had another name back then. There were Irish-American songs, Italian-American songs, and lots of Jewish-American songs. And the racial epithets were just sort of slung around. Kate Smith, yes. She has become politically incorrect. Nobody talks about the African American songs that Berlin wrote back then. Stop That Rag, Keep on Playing, Honey, 1909. Alexander and His Clarinet, Colored Romeo, 1910. And Alexander's ragtime band, the song that made Berlin rich and famous at age 23, well, you know, that was based on the conceit that, and this was widespread in those days, there were a number of songs that had the name Alexander in them. This was a way of making fun of black people, that Alexander was an absurdly dignified name, it was thought back then, for a black male to have. And it's horrible, it's reprehensible. We look at it from this distance and we regret it deeply, but those were those times.
I mean, he even has a blackface number in Holiday Inn.
That's correct, which is edited out on TV these days. And Bing Crosby, dressed up in blackface with long white sideburns. And but there was, within that song, Abraham was the name of the song. And it was a... it pains me to say it, but this is what it was. It was for Holiday Inn. It was about Lincoln's birthday, because the conceit of that show was, it was a show, the conceit of that show was there was an inn that was only open on holidays, and they had a song for each holiday, and there was one for Lincoln's birthday, and this was it, Abraham, right? And black people were supposed to be wildly grateful every minute of every day that the great savior Abraham Lincoln had set them free, which contains some truth and contains many, many strands of positive and negative, the negatives being ignored for this song. And so they had a blackface number, and Bing Crosby participated in it. The thing I was going to say is that Berlin actually used in that song initially the very epithet that was in the title of the song that got Kate Smith in such big trouble. Again, not the N-word, but another word almost equally bad. And Berlin got a letter from an African-American newspaper, an important African-American newspaper in Washington, D.C., decrying the use of this word in his lyric, and he changed it. He struck it from the lyric. So he was, he was highly intelligent, highly sensitive, and we should never forget that this is the man who, in the great review he wrote with Moss Hart at Thousands Cheer in 1933, wrote a song called Supper Time, which I believe preceded Strange Fruit by several years, and was about the same thing. It was a song about lynching.
So you didn't have to be a racist person to create music that today we consider racist. I mean, Bing Crosby was certainly not a racist. He was.
Bing Crosby worked with so many great black musicians, and much like Frank Sinatra, had huge respect for the black musicians he worked with, and emulated them.
Of course, Sinatra could be pretty insensitive with his in his Rat Pack days.
Well, he was.
Was Amos and Andy Pitts.
Sinatra was. Sinatra's a whole other story, and when he got drunk, all bets were off.
So do you think that it's possible for younger people to enjoy this music or these performances despite their racial insensitivity?
Well, I would not expect any young person to enjoy, any young person, white or black, to enjoy the playing of the song that got Kate Smith in trouble. I would not expect any young person or any old person, for that matter, white or black, to enjoy seeing that number Abraham from Holiday Inn, the blackface number. It's a very painful thing to watch. But I think that we can understand that that these things happened in the context of their times, which doesn't excuse them, but makes the story of the people who either performed them or wrote them a complicated matter. Life is complicated. It is not. It's full of grays, and this is a hard era in which to be discussing grays because everybody wants black and white. But I'm sorry, life is gray.
We're talking with James Kaplan, and his new book is called Irving Berlin, New York Genius. And let's just continue with this for just a minute. In your Sinatra book, I think it's in the first volume of your Sinatra book, you talk about those great milestone performers who set the stage, you know, for everybody else. And you start with Jolson, and Jolson was the first popular vocalist in America. But when you think about this stuff we've been talking about, is it impossible to appreciate Al Jolson today?
Well, I always think of Zelda Fitzgerald's quote about Jolson. Zelda said to Scott Fitzgerald, "Isn't he greater than Jesus?" And at the time, in that era, Al Jolson, a great, great, colossally great entertainer, and a terrible man by many accounts, a really terrible guy.
Yeah.
He was a phenomenon. He was a Mick Jagger. He was a Pavarotti. He was a, I don't know who you could begin to compare him to today, but he was a titanic popular performer and incredibly charismatic and a great singer of popular songs. I love hearing Al Jolson. I don't love seeing him perform in blackface. And I can't exactly say what black entertainers of the day felt about seeing Jolson perform in blackface. I think that might be a complicated subject on its own. I think that some people, and I'm not going to sit here and do this, but I think that some people do make the argument that blackface was a kind of tribute, maybe even kind of an envious tribute, to great African-American performers and music. But at the same time, I quickly add, it was a miserable, terrible visual representation of deep-set institutional racism that formed the basis of America in the early 20th century.
Today, there are still a lot of white performers who perform in an African-American idiom. They don't they don't use blackface. So is it the visual that makes the difference?
Boy, that is... I don't know. That's a big question. Yes, the visual does make a huge difference, and it's become such a hot button now that it's almost impossible to discuss between Ralph Northam or whatever the guy's name was and Justin Trudeau and this one and that one who gets discovered having blacked up as a kid, thinking that it was kind of fun, and now it's just just awful. It would be much easier for me to sit down across a table from my friend Christian McBride, a great man, a great musician, and discuss this. I would love to hear his thoughts on the matter. And I think it is difficult and improper, really, for me as one white male to opine on this.
All right, then. With that, let's listen to this record of Alexander's Ragtime Band, the song that put Irving Berlin on the map, as recorded by the great blues singer Bessie Smith.
Oh, my honey, you better hurry and let's go down there. Ain't you going to that little man, raggy meter man? Oh, honey, let me take you to Alexander, grandstand, brass band. Ain't you coming along? Come on in here, Alexander, the ragtime band. Come on in here, it's the best band in the land. They can play the bugle call like you never heard before. Sounds so natural that you want to go to war. That's just the best band in the land. Oh, honey, lamb, come on along. Come on along. Let me take you by the hand. Up to the man who is the leader of the band. And if you hear the yell of the Suwannee River played in ragtime, come on in here. Come on in here. Alexander's Ragtime Band.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with James Kaplan. He's the author of many books, including the biography of Frank Sinatra, and his new book is called Irving Berlin, New York Genius. When we think of Fred Astaire, we think, of course, of great dancing, but Astaire introduced more songs that became popular music standards than any other singer. Gershwin, Cole Porter, Jerome Kern all wrote great songs for Fred Astaire, and so did Irving Berlin. Here's a sampling of Berlin's Fred Astaire tunes.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where Harlem is? Putting on the ribbon, spangled gown upon the bevy of high browns from down the levee, all misfits. Putting on the ribbon, that's where each and every Lulu Bell goes. Every Thursday evening with her swell bows. Rubbing elbows, come with me, and we'll attend their jubilee, and see them spend their last 2 minutes putting on the red.
So I'm putting on the top hat, tying up a white tie, brushing off my tail. I'm duding up my shirt front, putting in the shirt studs, polishing my nails. I'm stepping out, my dear, to breathe an atmosphere that simply reeks with class. And I trust that you'll excuse my dust when I step on the gas. For I'll be there, putting down my top hat, mussing up a white tie, dancing in my tail. Isn't this a lovely day to be caught in the rain? You were going on your way, now you've got to remain. Just as you were going, leaving me all at sea. The clouds broke, they broke, and oh, what a break for me. I can see the sun up high, though we're caught in the storm. I can see where you and I could be cozy and warm. Let the rain pitter-patter, but it really doesn't matter if the skies are gray. Long as I can be with you, it's a lovely day. Heaven, I'm in heaven, and the cares that hung around me through the week seem to vanish like a gambler's lucky streak. When we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak. But it doesn't thrill me half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to go out fishing in a river or a creek. But I don't enjoy it half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Dance with me, I want my arm about you. The charm about you will carry me through to heaven. I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find the happiness I seek. When we're out together dancing cheek to cheek.
Fred Astaire, James Kaplan, was the beneficiary of some great Irving Berlin tunes.
Yeah, Fred Astaire, to my mind, is one of the very few great interpreters of the American songbook of the 20th century, and not by any means a powerhouse voice. In strictly physical terms, but in emotional terms and musical terms and poetic terms and interpretational terms, a huge powerhouse. I get goosebumps when I listen to Astaire sing, even though it may seem on the face of it to be a thin and kind of weak voice. It's a contradiction. It is a great voice. It's a very important voice. And Berlin and he formed they fell in love with each other, really, at first sight. As soon as Berlin started writing for Astaire, they saw how similar that each was to the other in many ways. Elegant dress, fidelity to their wives, sense of humor, and especially work ethic. Nobody worked harder than Berlin. Nobody worked harder than Astaire.
Do you think it's because he was a fine actor that he was such a good singer?
Was he a fine actor? You know, when you say that, I think of a certain cute little take that Astaire would do in his movies when he was trying to show he was in love. A little sort of smiling semi-swoon he would do, and it was cute, a little corny. I'm not sure I think of him as a great actor. I just think that... Astaire had deep roots way back in vaudeville, performing with his sister Adele, song and dance act, and something about, and she was, you know, it's a tragedy. There's no film of Adele Astaire. that I know of. I don't think there is, certainly not of her performing.
Yeah.
But apparently she was just as great, and some people said greater than Fred. I think they were a brother and sister pair of geniuses, and that's that. So whether he was a great actor, I'm not sure, but certainly just as great an interpreter of popular songs as in his own way as Sinatra was.
Judy Garland also,
of course,
benefited from Irving Berlin's songs in her career.
Yes, another, to speak of another genius. And again, they're very rare. They're very, very rare. I mean, there are any number of great, there's Louis Armstrong, there's Bessie Smith, there's Ethel Waters, there's Judy Garland. And by the way, Bessie Smith, we should not forget, did the greatest version of all of Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Hmm.
But Judy Garland, yes, Judy Garland certainly benefited from working with Berlin, and they loved each other too.
And you were mentioning earlier that Irving Berlin was also a lyricist as well as being a melody composer. And, you know, when I first saw Hamilton and I heard the Hamilton soundtrack, and everybody was excited about Hamilton, and I think Hamilton is great, not to take anything away from Hamilton.
Yeah.
But the idea of having, you know, one of the things that people talked about was the great rhymes in Hamilton.
Yes.
But if you look at songs like Doing What Comes Naturally or You Can't Get a Man with a Gun.
Yeah.
Those rhymes, I mean, then some of those go on for many verses of incredibly great rhymes.
Yes, and not only great rhymes, but beautifully crafted rhymes, unexpected rhymes. Again, going back to Putting on the Ritz, listen, look at where the rhymes are in that song, see where they fall in what unexpected places, and with what unexpected accents. How brilliantly clever they are, how totally natural they seem, how completely simple they seem. And simplicity was Berlin's great watchword. It was his great ethic. It was simplicity was God to him. And he just, nobody really understands except for somebody who works in the same medium, how unbelievably difficult it is to achieve simplicity. He would sweat blood throughout the night. He was a nighttime worker, Berlin, and to achieve simplicity. Blue Skies, I think, is one of the most awesome examples of simplicity in lyricism, in lyric writing, and in melody writing.
And White Christmas is another one. People might know that one, White Christmas. All the greatest Christmas songs are written by Jews. It's interesting.
Well, a lot of them are. There was a while when Jews wouldn't touch Christmas songs, and one of the most important secular, now we can say secular, Christmas songs, Jingle Bells, was actually written in 1854 for Thanksgiving. How about that? Climate was different then, Gary.
That's right. That's right. There was snow.
Yeah, there was snow, exactly, instead of wildfires.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's really a fantastic book, and I'm so
Thanks.
Glad that you wrote it. Irving Berlin, New York genius, and another New York genius wrote the book. His name is James Kaplan, and he's my guest.
Oh, hell.
Thanks for being with us on From the Book Show.
Oh, thank you. It's a great pleasure, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.